Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
It's Thursday, November 7th from HBR2. It's The Conversation. With required pre-approval from HECO and the pressure to have only electricians install PV systems, the solar industry is trying to keep its sunny outlook. Today, we'll ask how and teaching the rest of us what it's like to be house but not homeless.
We'll talk with one of the houseless performers in a new project to share the voices of those living on the streets in Hawaii and one of the organizations backing the show. Also, a preview of Lee Cataluna's new work, Flowers of Hawaii.
All that starts right after this news. Good morning. This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Good morning, Chris Vanderkirk.
Good morning, Beth Ann. I found my thoughts turning towards solar energy because we're sitting here freezing in the studio this morning.
Yeah, that's sort of our sad little secret, that it is so cold in CR7. And for years, we've tried to have it fixed, and somehow it just stays cold in this little room. So occasionally our teeth chatter. Well, I guess everybody will have to forgive us.
We'll try to keep it to a minimum. Yeah.
We will do. But, you know, recently we talked about, or talked with a solar provider about the challenges facing customers now being told that they have to get pre-approval from HECO to install their systems because of the limitations on the grid. And then very recently came a move to require installers to also be licensed electricians. Now, this morning we're asking how the once quick-growing industry billed as the energy savior for customers is trying to stay on the sunny side of the street. Leslie Cole Brooks is the executive director of the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, and she's in studio with us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, you're going to have to pretend to be warm, too.
I know. I'll do my best here. I'll think about the sun.
So how are you handling all of this? Because your industry was just really touted as being so much the be-all, end-all. Customers were being encouraged to do it for a variety of reasons. It just seemed that as if there were, you know, no end to the impetus for people to go solar. And then smack comes this whole issue with HECO asking that now people have to get pre-approval for their systems because of the grid issues. And then very recently, as we just said, this move to require that those who install your PV system also have to be electricians, sort of from soup to nuts.
Yeah, we have a lot of challenges right now, starting with here on Oahu with the new rules that went into place September 6th, that now, depending on what kind of circuit or the status of your circuit, if it's green, meaning there's still room, yellow, iffy, and then red if it's saturated or penetration up to the level that they're looking at. So it's really slowed things down as the permit count for September compared to last year. It's pretty abysmal. And, you know, we're just doing the best we can to work with the utility and see if we can get past this first hump, because they've just been flooded with applications. And now that they're having to do a pre-approval, they just weren't prepared for it, I don't think. And we're doing everything we can to work with them to move those through. But then we had the bigger issues of what to do with this penetration issue. And there are a lot of opportunities, but unfortunately it has slowed us down, and it's going to be a really tough last quarter of the year.
And it's also caught a lot of other people in the lurch. Meanwhile,
yes,
you know, this is, as you say, so slow, and people not necessarily being able to get what they would like to have if they want to have solar, other people who already have it and can't connect. Is it too late for us to be saying, well, you know, they should have seen this coming?
No, I don't think it's too late to say that, but it's kind of spilt milk at this point. And we all knew that the penetration levels were certainly increasing. We've been doubling every year since 2008. So it's not a big surprise, but the concern is that the studies that should have been done to determine how we can move forward, it seems that they're being done now, and we just wish that we had the information a lot sooner, because clearly we were moving at a very rapid pace, and people love to generate their own electricity. So
This seems to be a similar refrain to what we hear a lot. Oh, we should have done this sooner. This should have happened first. Is there something peculiar about us that we don't tend to look at doing things in a right and orderly way? Do we just not know enough about how to do, I mean, just an organizational, you know, list of to-dos?
I don't know if it's because we live in paradise that everything seems to be so beautiful and wonderful every day. I don't know what it is, because I tend to be more of a planner and sort of expect the worst and hope for the best. So why we're at this point now, I really don't know, but it does seem that it's relaxed. But we do know now that there are things we can do, and we're really hoping to work with the utility, the industry working with the utility to address these penetration issues, because there are a lot of very innovative things that can be done to increase the penetration. And to be fair, we are at the very forefront here in Hawaii, because we have the highest penetration levels of the nation. So I want to use that as an opportunity to show what can be done. We're like this big laboratory for renewables here in Hawaii.
So what's the top thing that you'd like to see happen that you think is really within the realm of possibility in a fairly short time frame?
Well, in the most immediate, we want to grandfather in those customers who have been truly stuck in the middle, who had made all these financial commitments, like gotten out loans or re-roofed, things like that, anticipating they'd get on under a 10-kilowatt system without pre-approval and all these sorts of things that are stopping them. It's just as a matter of good faith, those customers should get in. There aren't that many. And then to work with the less saturated or less with less penetration circuits to move those through, to try to get some business happening here in the last quarter, because it's everything is kind of stalled out. So that's the most immediate. Then the next thing is to we're looking at bringing in third-party engineers and working with the utility to send and look at these more innovative ways that we can have more penetration on the grid. So
I mean, clearly this is the bigger issue of the two that we brought up with you this morning, but I don't want to let you go without getting to that second one. Did you even see it coming that suddenly the electricians and plumbers union would want to have the PV installers be electricians from soup to nuts instead of just sort of being the ones to finally do the wiring and to plug it all in?
No, that was a real surprise for me. So I say that my job, just about every day there's a fire drill, but that was a fire I hadn't anticipated. We've had two hearings now, and the Board of Electricians and Plumbers has deferred that to next December, their next meeting. So essentially what that's about is looking at the technology, what's going on the roof right now, and at what point should an EJ or electrical journeyman be part of the installation. Now, some are saying they should be part of the installation from the very beginning. From the beginning, that is, you know, drilling in the holes into the roof and putting in flashing the racks and all that. Or should they be part as the point where the wiring is involved, which is after the array has been laid down and put in place? It would be another tremendous blow if the photovoltaic license was eliminated. The cost would go up and things would really slow down, because there aren't that many EJs. So,
as an electrical journeyman.
Right. They're like gods and goddesses, I think of them, on the island already, because people are keeping them on payroll just because they don't want to lose them. So
that, coupled with the bigger issue with HECO, might mean that there would be slow upon slow.
Yes.
All right. Well, we're going to check back with you next month when you have the next hearing
okay.
to see how things are going.
Okay.
Leslie, welcome back to the islands, and thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Leslie Cole Brooks is the executive director of the nonprofit trade organization, the Hawaii Solar Energy Association. Ms. Cole Brooks is an attorney, a member of the California and Hawaii State Bar Associations, and a trained geologist.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:14, and later in the show, a bouquet of Lee Cataluna family drama, the one to beat for a congressional seat, and right now, your quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, miha ukawa ua umuloka ulana umau ukaholabe uhangai.
We just talked about the solar industry and challenges to it this morning. While we're still looking skyward, consider this. Shortly after 11 p.m. on July 8, 1962, the night sky above Hawaii turned to day. This was not a spectacular act of nature or astronomy, but the after effect of weapons testing near to the islands. The source of light on that July evening came from a high-altitude nuclear test carried out by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission and the Defense Atomic Support Agency. During the test, they detonated a warhead about 250 miles above a point southwest of Johnston Atoll. The explosion was equivalent to 1.4 megatons of TNT. The electromagnetic pulse generated from that blast was greater than expected and managed to cause electrical damage and blown streetlights throughout the islands. For this morning's quiz, we're wondering if you can tell us the name of the test operation. And here's a hint. The event was part of an even larger nuclear testing effort, Operation Fishbowl. Stay with us. We'll light up the answer a little later in the show.
Gives way, and suddenly it's day again. The sun is in the east, even though the day is done.
Hi, good morning. I'm Bill Hummel from Hawaii Pacific University. You're listening to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. Find out more about the show at hpr2.org.
You probably don't need us to tell you this. Few relationships are as intense as complicated as those within a family. Parents expect so much from their children. Teenagers often feel the need to separate and forge their own identity. Marriages are strained by pressures nobody expected. Hawaii's family dramas are played out against a unique cultural background, one that playwright Lee Cataluna is well-positioned to understand. She's chronicled local life in her plays with affection and humor in her past theatrical comedies. Now she's bringing that insight to a series of dramatic vignettes called Flowers of Hawaii. It's a Kumukahua production. Harry Wong is the director. Harry's with us this morning. Good morning, Harry.
Good morning.
You know, in Lee's past work, she's shown a great deal of understanding of what it means to be from here in ways that nobody from outside could really describe. Does that carry forward into this new work?
Yes, I do. I do think that that happens in this work too. I think the interesting thing though for Lee is that she's taking it into, I guess, a more serious kind of vein, and then treating the characters, you know, I mean, to be honest, like more realistically rather than satire or rather than
less exaggeration.
Rather than just comic effect, rather than stereotypes, maybe even. And so then I think the effect, because the humor is still there, is that there's more of a roller coaster ride emotionally, even throughout the vignettes.
Well, families are a very good place for roller coaster rides, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Every transaction in a family is so fraught in ways that it wouldn't be if you weren't related. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I think one of the interesting things too is that the vignettes, although they're very separate, because it's a family, there's effects that happen in one family's life that kind of carry over even into people who you haven't seen yet on stage, to characters that are, you know, like maybe in the first scene. It affects something that happens in the fifth scene. And then it's being able to track that through like a family history, where there's, I think it's Freud, that there's a psychological resemblance, a family resemblance between one action that happens here and then another action that may happen even like between a generation.
And these are all dynamics that we're likely to recognize at some point resonate in our own lives and lives of people we've known.
Yeah, sure. You know, I mean, before you can be universal, you have to be local, I think.
Yeah.
You know, like the Greeks, they wrote about the Greeks, and Ibsen wrote about, is it Norway? He wrote about Norway, and Shakespeare wrote about England.
Yeah.
And then so the writers here, they're writing about Hawaii, but even then, I think there's echoes in, like, anybody's life, I think. I think anybody can come and say, oh, my goodness, my family is just like that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you make a really good point, Harry, because you could describe Chekhov as a regional playwright.
Oh, yeah.
You know, very almost insular in terms of – and yet by concentrating so much on the local, you become universal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's because – I think because whenever you do that and you're really writing about something you know, then those interactions that are just kind of basic become recognizable, you know. I think there's a scene in Chekhov where, you know, two people, they love each other, but they talk about everything except that.
Yeah.
And then in that one moment, their possible future is just stopped. You know, and I think everybody has that kind of moment in their life where, you know, what just happened? Did I just end something? Did I just begin something?
Yeah.
And then it's being able to come back to that. And then unless you're focusing on very clearly exactly people you know or yourself, you know, as certain individuals, only then as an individual can you see that kind of moment played out in everybody's life.
You know, and you also made me think of the kind of moments, very powerful moments in our lives where, as with that Chekhov scene you just described, where the emotions in play are being hidden rather than being expressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so then, that's the tool of the playwright is subtext.
Yeah.
Yeah, so then, I mean, you know, a mother and daughter in our play, they might be talking about baking a cake.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but then actually there's a secret that the mother has, and then she's trying to keep that secret. And the daughter, rather than just talking about the cake, understands that there's a secret the mother's keeping, and she's trying to bring it out. But really what they're talking about is baking a cake.
And that requires a great deal of theatrical craft. Has to start with the writer,
mm-hmm.
but then also for you as the director and for the cast, you have to make sure that's evoked very clearly. Otherwise, it's just two people talking about baking a cake.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's one of the good things about this play, actually, is that you know the writing is good when the actors, they just fall into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the writing is good because the actors, if the actors are also good, they just kind of sense like what they need to be doing.
Yeah.
And then as a director, you know, the best thing you can do as a director is to stay out of the way.
Well, it's refreshing, Gary, to hear a director say that, because you also hear about directors who sort of impose line readings and things like that. And what you're saying is that you step in when needed.
It depends on the play.
Sure.
I think that when the play is well written, then all you're trying to do is navigate, and then the job is even harder. You're just trying to find the right way, you know, the right way to follow the subtext without crashing on either side of, oh my God, Scylla and Charybdis. But then you're like banging into a glacier here and a glacier there. You're just trying to navigate that narrow path, that one path that, you know, rather than a simple scene, just explodes into different kinds of emotions and different kinds of. Yeah.
It's always good to hear a good classical reference like Scylla and Charybdis.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a winner. I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem.
No, it's great to talk to you, and it really sounds like a particularly interesting production for you, yeah?
Oh, yeah. It's been wonderful so far, and the cast is tremendous.
Terrific. Thanks very much for coming in this morning.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Harry Wong is the director of Flowers of Hawaii, a world premiere play by Lee Cataluna. It's a series of vignettes about family life in our islands. It's a Kumukahua production, runs weekends until December 8th at its downtown Honolulu Theater, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
Again, the conversation is brought to you with pride by Hawaii Public Radio's family of members, volunteers, and community partners. Mahalo to Hawaiian Historical Society, Excelsior Lodge No. 1, the Independent Order of Odd Fellows, and Hawaii HR for your generous support of Celebration 2013. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. You're listening to The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. So, what can age, experience, smarts, ambition, name recognition, and a knack for raising a lot of money amount to? Well, if you're Donna Mercata Kim, it might mean you're the one to beat for the congressional seat. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair joins us for today's reality check. Good morning, Chad.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Donna Mercata Kim is often seen as a force of nature. You know, this woman's never lost a race. Does that make her unbeatable for everybody else who's in that pack?
I wouldn't say unbeatable, but think about this. There's now six people running for Colleen Hanabusa's seat, and Donna Kim, far and away, has the greatest name recognition. She's been in office for over three decades now. That's the city council, the House of Representatives. Now she's the Senate president. Imagine if this is primary day and you have six people to choose from. Who's going to get your vote? Well, chances are name recognition is going to help a great deal. You only need 15 or 20% of the vote to win this thing. So I'd give Kim certainly front-runner status, at least for now. But certainly she has changed the tenor of this race.
There are those, though, who say that, you know, she shouldn't get it just because she has some of those things. But really, we're talking about the experience to go to Washington and to be able to act in that realm, not necessarily what's, you know, happened in Hawaii through either the city council or in the Senate. Is there enough experience there to send her to Washington?
You know, it's a good question. Think about it. We sent Tulsi Gabbard to Washington with very little experience, comparatively speaking. I think what all the candidates have in common so far is they think that they can be the one to somehow best represent Washington in this terrible partisan atmosphere that we see in D.C. And of those six, one thing you can say about Donna Kim, she's tough, she's aggressive, she does not back down. That might inspire some people who want to fight her in Washington, particularly when we're so concerned in the wake of Dana Noy's death about, you know, getting federal funding for the state.
I mean, it's not a bad thing to be a fighter. And if you are, no. And particularly if you're a woman, sometimes they mislabel you something else.
That's exactly right. And we're not going to go there, but people can use their imagination on that one. You know, think about this. We actually have three women representing us in Washington right now. That's a historic first for the state. There were more women in elective office. In the Senate, there were more women than there have been before. Colleen Hanabusa, of course, trying to join that crowd and defeat Brian Schatz. But, you know, Donna Kim's father, her late father, was a boxer and actually a welterweight, and says instilled that fighting spirit in her daughter. And often voters are looking for the one who's hungry, the one who is going to get out there and not back down. This race is far from over, but certainly Donna Kim has to be considered a serious candidate. By the way, she's really good at raising money, as we mentioned as well. That's the other big factor in a race like this.
And very briefly, I mean, anything else going to haunt her about, you know, the way she talked to MRC Greenwood about her son's application to law school, any of that?
I think you're definitely going to see some of that. A lot of people still upset for what she did with UH. But let's talk more about that another day.
Well, we will. Thanks. Chad Blair is the political reporter for CivilBeat.com.
Good morning. I'm Chris Vandercook. It's 8:30. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. Coming up, a theatrical project with a houseless view, seven of them, in fact. But first, international news from the BBC. Tonight at 5 on Town Square, Beth Ann, you'll be taking on a topic that's been much in the air this past week.
Yes, the special session and the fact that we've gone into week two, which wasn't exactly unexpected, although not necessarily planned for in the way we were discussing it publicly. But tonight we're going to build a panel and talk about where we are right now and most likely what will happen after the vote tomorrow, and then how we move toward seeing this move through our community and what kind of healing we need to do with our community.
Well, I would suspect, given the testimony, just the sheer volume of it on both sides, that there's going to be a fair amount of healing no matter which way it goes, right?
Right. And there's still the issue of what will be the rule of law. Tonight, we're going to be talking with Vanessa Chung, the executive director of the ACLU, and bringing back Professor Carol Peterson, who is the director of the Matsunaga Institute for Peace. She was here with us last week. And adding to the mix, Governor Abercrombie's deputy chief of staff and former Representative Blake Oshiro will be here.
What will be the rule of law, and what is the role of law in social issues, yeah?
Well, that's the subject of all the testimony that we've been seeing.
Exactly.
And certainly we talked about that yesterday with the head of SHOPO and what he had to say and how that angered people on one side or the other about what was appropriate or what wasn't appropriate to be said in that context.
It's a very fraught subject.
Yes, as somebody I would know, it's fraught with fraughtness. That's what it is. But beyond just that and a little bit of humor poked at it, it's going to be a serious issue for us as we try to move it through the community. And when you think about all the other things that at one time or other were seen as being almost insurmountable, and how somehow, because we're a fairly resilient bunch in a lot of ways, we're able to make that jump.
It's worth remembering that it's been quite a long journey just to get to this moment.
And that's not being lost.
Yeah.
And certainly, whereas it will be most likely a celebratory moment for those who have been pushing this for a long time, it's also going to be done with the view that this has to be reconciled in our community, especially as we are in this small community called Hawaii.
Exactly. That's tonight at 5 on Town Square. Thanks, Bethann.
Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
Moving on now, the latest point in time count for Hawaii's homeless shows a steadily growing population on Oahu alone from about 3,600 in 2009 to a little over 4,500 this year. But those are just statistics. Behind them are real people with real stories. Stories that the backers of the Houseless in Paradise theatrical project believe that the rest of us need to hear. Catholic Charities Hawaii CEO Jerry Rockhorst is among them. We talked early this morning, and I asked him whether the faces of the houseless have changed the way we all look at them.
Homelessness is just so obvious. You know, it's kind of in front of all of us every day in some way or another. You know, that people are at the point of, you know, desiring to understand it a little bit better. And I think what they're finding out is there are many pathways to homelessness. So, you know, in some cases it could be a job loss. In another case, it could have something to do with mental illness. In another case, it could have something to do with, you know, drug or alcohol addiction. And in some cases, it's just some traumatic experience that's happened, you know, in a person or in a family's life. So I think people are really struggling to try to understand, you know, what is this all about? And how do people end up in these kinds of circumstances? Because you can't help to, you know, have some empathy, especially when you see what's going on in the community, you know, with the tents and the number of people that, you know, are actually impacted.
The recession made it all more visible for us, and certainly to the visitor industry, trying
Absolutely.
To, you know, move it and massage it and make it not so visible. Did we do a service or a disservice to the people who were homeless?
I think probably a combination. You know, on the one hand, you know, I think we really have tried to reach out as a community to, you know, provide some options, and options that are a whole lot better in some instances than, you know, living in the park or living on a sidewalk, providing some services so that, you know, if in fact a family or an individual does go to a homeless shelter, there are many, many wraparound services that are available So you're not isolated. You're not kind of on your own. So I think from that standpoint, we've really done a service. On the other hand, I think because even service providers grapple with these many different reasons that folks become homeless, you know, I think there is this tendency just to want to, you know, in a sense, get them out of the picture, take them off of the landscape so that we don't necessarily have to look at them, see them, be aware of how significant the issue is. So I think it's really a combination of both.
Very often we get groups telling us, well, we have X number of people who are homeless here or Y there, and we see the state's point in time count. That seems to objectify real people.
Yes.
As we look at this and try to put some context to how we continue to grapple with it now, and programs like Family Promise that's brought the faith community into it and sort of in an ecumenical sort of way, that we have to do a better job in humanizing this. Do you rate us any better now at doing that than say, even 5 years ago?
I think we are doing a better job of that. And, you know, the production that's coming up, Houseless in Paradise, I think is just one example of how we do that. I know that at Catholic Charities Hawaii, you know, we are constantly working to try to create more awareness and understanding so that, you know, folks that are leaders in the community really have an understanding, again, of these many pathways that lead to homelessness, and also how complex the issue is in our community. And you kind of alluded to that earlier, that, you know, there are no simple solutions necessarily. There are many solutions, and it just depends on, you know, what pathway has led to homelessness. That's going to dictate what solution may be a little bit more effective in trying to alleviate this problem.
Do you think that from a state and city level, particularly as we look at Honolulu and Oahu and homelessness, has this fallen off the radar for most people?
I do not think so. In fact, I'm probably more hopeful right now than I've ever been. You know, from the standpoint of the state and the city and county, you know, really grappling with this issue, really looking for solid solutions. People who have been following the issue, you know, hear a lot about the Housing First model. And, you know, I think that's going to make a tremendous difference in our community as far as, you know, really addressing the needs. But unfortunately, you know, given the nature of that model, the cost that's involved, you know, it's going to take some time. So, you know, we're not going to see, like, immediate huge results. It's going to be over time. But I think the effectiveness of moving in this direction is going to prove, you know, very significant. And that's why I say, you know, I'm just so hopeful right now, because it seems that, you know, the state and the city and county are really, really working very, very close together when it comes to this issue.
When you say that, you know, we're moving to the Housing First, which we've talked about on the show before, and how that's a little bit different from the way we were looking at it before with how do we get services and trying to integrate all this together, but first get people in a safe place. We've had a lot of disagreement about what we do about things like tent cities and people just camping out, and there's been a lot of acrimony about this. Has this become so divisive that we can't really focus on the program because people are too busy trying to be right?
No, I don't think so. I just think that, you know, it's going to take more time and more results. And I think once people begin to see the results, the divisiveness is going to be curtailed. And people, I think, are really going to, you know, jump on the bandwagon, if you will, and get behind this effort.
While we're waiting for all these things to sort of catch up, and obviously it's going to be a while, as you say, does that mean that it's more incumbent upon individuals and small groups to do something of what they can? And we talked a little earlier about the Family Promise program that doesn't handle, you know, a huge amount of families, but it still makes a significant impact for those families that it helps.
Yes. I mean, I think it's incumbent upon all of us to, you know, to do what we can and to get involved in the ways that we can. And, you know, there are many ways, you know, everything from volunteering at River of Life to getting involved with some of the the programs at Catholic Charities Hawaii. One of the real exciting kind of developments that's happened in the last year with Catholic Charities Hawaii is just, you know, forming partnerships, for instance, with Maryknoll High School. And the students at Maryknoll High School, you know, spent the entire year collecting articles that would be very important, kind of like the essential articles that you would need to have around your home. And for the homeless that we've been working with, that we've been able to get into rental situations, this becomes like, you know, essentially a care package for them with all of the essential items that they're going to need as they start their new life, you know, in this rental property. And it just makes a huge difference. And again, when you think about it, it's not only what's being assembled and brought together for the homeless, but it's also the education and the learning and the understanding that takes place, you know, among the high school students at the same time. So it's kind of a win-win all the way around.
Do we need to get to more kids at the high school level and let them see this side of life, that, you know, it's not a case of where, you know, you do X, Y, and Z and your life is wonderful, but that life really can take turns and you need to be more resilient and more forethinking about how things can change by seeing really what's out there? Do they need a dose of reality more than they're getting now?
Oh, I believe so. I mean, I think you're making an excellent point. And, you know, it just seems that, you know, at a young age, you know, there's this optimism, there's this excitement about future and career and potential and all of that kind of thing. But the realities of life are there. And, you know, I think the more that high school students can be exposed to, you know, the possibilities, and, you know, it's not to create a pessimism, but rather, again, the dose of reality that you just mentioned, that, you know, there are many things that can happen along this pathway called life.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Jerry Rockhorst is the Chief Executive Officer of Catholic Charities Hawaii and is one of the organizations involved in the Houseless in Paradise project.
How many of us have turned away from homeless people we pass on the street, avoiding eye contact? Better question, who among us has not? As we heard earlier this morning, there's a determined effort underway to help us understand the human story using theater as the vehicle. Jeff Souza is a cast member of Houseless in Paradise, a Playbuilders Hawaii production. His words and his story are up there on the stage, and he's with us this morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jeff. It's a pretty intense experience making theater out of something that you've lived, isn't it?
It really is, because you have to put a filter of what you want people to know and what you don't want them to know because of embarrassment or shame.
Sure.
And this has been part of my journey through this effort, is learning what I'm free to talk about comfortably and what I will share with those who are closest to me, and but discerning the difference.
There's a real benefit for others to be had from your discarding your embarrassment.
Absolutely. And that is the reason that I got involved in this project. Once I realized that the purpose of the play was to show the diversity of the many different factions of homeless people, and to allow them to tell their own stories by way of audio, which was then put into a proper order to make mm-hmm. a presentation. Once I learned that that was the meaning of the project, I wanted to get involved. I was staying at a transitional shelter mm-hmm. when we got a fax about the project. And several of us who lived there were asked if we'd like to participate. So I, having been an actor and a singer in the past, mm-hmm. decided that that would be something that I'd enjoy doing.
It was also going to be a struggle for you.
Yes. Yes. Talking about my piece speaks to people who became homeless because of financial difficulties that are often the case when one finds out that one has AIDS, mm-hmm. or one turns to drugs after they find out they have AIDS. Mm-hmm. And that is part of my story. And this is what makes it difficult to discuss, because a lot of it is embarrassment for poor choices. But if anyone can benefit from my sharing my embarrassment of poor choices, perhaps they won't be making those choices. And that's one of the messages that I want people to understand through my piece, is when I found out that I was HIV positive. Of course, back 27 years ago, they didn't have that classification. Everyone was in the same boat in their eyes.
You had AIDS, and it was a death sentence.
Yes, it was a death sentence, and I believed them, unfortunately. So my life discontinued as it was going along. I just stopped everything. And it's important for me to know that if someone today or tomorrow is told that they're HIV positive, that they realize that there is a whole lot of life left to be lived if they take care of themselves and follow their doctor's prescriptions and such.
That's an enormously valuable piece of information to pass on.
And that's why I became involved. I had the fortune of doing that once in 1992. I'd been HIV positive for 7 years, and was introduced to a young woman who was about to be told she was HIV positive, who had stated that she was going to take her own life if that were the case. Mm-hmm. And it was an amazing thing to know that something that I shared with her helped her get through these difficulties. But I digress from homelessness.
But you know what, Jeff? The fact that you've got that behind you, and you said there was a time when you gave up, what you've learned since then, let me put some words in your mouth, is that redemption is always available.
Absolutely.
As long as you're alive. Is
Absolutely.
That fair to say?
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
So that's a huge lesson for you.
It is.
And therefore a lesson to pass along, right?
Yes, yes. We have many stories of redemption, many of the stories that run through our play, including some of the known speeches from some of our local politicians, mm-hmm. that share their concerns and the ways that they're going to help the homeless get back. We call our project Houseless in Paradise because there are many people who are homeless that have their home wherever they are.
Yeah.
When you are with your family, whether you're in a tent, under a tree, at the beach, that is your home. Mm-hmm. And because you don't have a house, it's not necessarily going to be a situation where you're homeless. And some people who are houseless take offense to the term homeless.
Because it implies that their lives are missing something fundamental, right?
Exactly. And there are many people who have wonderful lives that just want to be in the open, that it's their choice.
You know that thing that moment I described just before we started talking, where you're walking down the street and you avoid eye contact with somebody who's sitting on the curb? You've seen that.
I've seen it. I've done it. I've had it done to me.
You bet.
And probably at the worst times of my life, I can remember sitting at the corner of Smith and Hotel Street and just watching people go by and seeing someone that I knew. Mm-hmm. I had been a professional singer and fallen back into drugs through depression. Mm-hmm. And here comes someone that I know down the street. And it was very, very difficult. I had to get up and leave, and they still saw me, chased me down.
So they wanted to talk to you.
Yes.
You didn't want to talk to them.
I was embarrassed. I was ashamed.
Just,
and I'm fearful that a little bit of that is going on, because when you realize that people you love see that your circumstances are not what they have believed them to be, there's an embarrassment there. There's a feeling of failure.
Well, Jeff, you have also, I don't doubt this, you've seen that everybody takes some some knocks at one time or another. No one. Have you ever met anyone who's immune?
No, no. And that's another thing that our play tries to project, to display, I should say, is that there are more people than we could imagine that are one paycheck away from not being able to pay their rent.
You bet.
Beginning to have to use their money instead of rent to pay for lawyers to stop an eviction, and all of a sudden they wind up with nothing and are homeless.
It's not an isolated issue by any means, and I really applaud and thank you for coming.
We address that quite a bit throughout the play.
That's
that
great.
Anyone can be in our shoes.
Jeff, and thanks for coming in this morning.
Thank you so very much for having me.
My pleasure.
Okay.
Jeff Souza is a member of the cast of Houseless in Paradise, performed the next three weekends at locations around Honolulu. It's a Playbuilders production, and you can get details from our HPR2.org website.
Good morning. My name is Lillian Cunningham, retired English teacher from Windward Community College, and you're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier this morning, we brought you back to the evening of July 8, 1962, for our backyard quiz. Shortly after 11 p.m. on that night, the sky turned from its usual indigo into a vibrant array of light and color. But the source wasn't an act of nature. It was the product of a nuclear weapons test carried out by the U.S. Atomic Energy Commission. It detonated a W-49 thermonuclear warhead about 250 miles above a point to the southwest of Johnston Atoll. The test bomb yielded a blast equivalent to 1.4 megatons of TNT, and along with the light display, the explosion was powerful enough to produce electromagnetic pulses that damaged electrical systems and blew out streetlights. Today, we asked you for the name of the test. The answer is Starfish Prime. It's 8:55. That's today's quiz. And if you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hawaii Public Radio kicks off its Atherton Studio winter season on Friday, November 15th. Travel back to Hawaii's golden era with the sweet sounds of the Bobby Ngano Trio. Steel guitar master Bobby Ngano teams up with Gary Aiko and Kaipo Asing Friday, November 15th at 7:30 p.m. in HPR's Atherton Studio. For tickets, call 955-8821 during business hours.
The October jobs report comes out on Friday, and it's usually a surprise, except for one particular category.
The black unemployment rate is typically twice that of the white unemployment rate, in good times and even in bad times.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Not all unemployment is created equal. We'll tell you more next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6.
Beth Ann, we talked to one of the performers just now from Houseless in Paradise, and it obviously took a great deal of courage for him to tell his story in theater, but I thought he made a very good point about his reasons for telling that story, the benefit that it could provide to others.
And to get the rest of us sort of on the same page and not to just objectify a group of people composed of so many different individuals with different reasons for being houseless.
Yeah, and, you know, there but for the grace of God, and it's... Yet we've all had that moment, I think, of walking down the street and kind of avoiding the eye contact with a person in need because we don't want to be reminded, in a sense, not of their need, but we also don't want to be reminded of our own.
That it could happen to us.
And perhaps our own inadequacy to deal with the problems that might come our way or the problems that might come the way of that person we see on the street.
I mean, just the point, especially knowing how many people are maybe one or two paychecks away or if you have even a very comfortable lifestyle, but something happens, something catastrophic. I guess it makes the point that there isn't a safe zone in life.
No.
And you just have to keep at it.
It's fragile and therefore precious.
Well, that's going to do it for that bit of talk for today. Mm-hmm. We're going to come back with you with more tomorrow. And on the agenda, should wells be closed, or rather the ones that were closed because of contamination, should they be opened again? Well, there are Maui folks who say that even with safety precautions that are being talked about now, they don't think the water is going to be safe.
And reliving the Hawaii experiences of one of America's greatest authors.
You can find us and each other on Facebook or tweet us at HI Conversation or get to me at BecauseHPR. And if you like email, we've got that too. talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. That does it for this Thursday. We'll meet you in the morning, though, for more of The Conversation.